I'm Chris Bend, a theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Shaul Kellner, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Jewish Studies, about his recent book, Tours That Bind, Diaspora, Pilgrimage, and Israeli Birthright Tourism. Shaul, thank you for being part of this.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here.
Great. We'll get right into the questions. And the first question goes to the issue of what you're studying. Since the year 1999, about 200,000 young people have traveled on free tours of Israel under the auspices of a program called Taglit Birthright Israel. What is Taglit Birthright Israel? What are its purposes, and why did you feel like studying it?
Taglit Birthright Israel is a series of free trips to Israel for diaspora Jews. The trips are intended to strengthen Jewish identity, to forge a connection with the state of Israel among diaspora Jews, among Jews who don't live there. It's understood by the people who are involved in designing and implementing the program as a program in Jewish education and Jewish identity building. And it's actually the latest in maybe a 50-plus year series of diaspora Jewish tours to Israel, tours that are specifically geared toward teenagers and young adults that are really intended to shape the way that they understand themselves as Jews and understand themselves in relationship to the state of Israel. What is different about Birthright Israel, or Birthright for short, compared to the earlier Israel trips that were going on, is that these trips are for free. This is something that diaspora Jewish philanthropists and communal charities, the Jewish Federation system, and the Israeli government, with their tax dollars, they're paying for this. The participants don't spend a dime on it, and it's presented to them, the trip is presented to them as a gift from the Jewish people.
And how did you get interested in this particular program? I mean, why did you decide to study it?
When I was in high school in 1987, I participated in a trip. These trips are called Israel Experience Programs. Mm. And I participated in an Israel Experience Program that was run through my synagogue youth group. It was a six-week tour of Israel, and it was a fantastic experience. Mm. And at the end of this summer, I knew I wanted to go back to Israel to spend more time there. And the counselors on the trip said, well, you can do what we did, which is go spend a year or a semester studying at Hebrew University when you're in college. And I did that. And I actually pulled out a Jewish studies major from doing that. I had not entered my undergraduate studies doing Jewish studies. And when I came back to George Washington University, which is where I was doing my undergrad, with this Jewish studies major in hand, I realized, you know, I really enjoy doing Jewish studies. And I was also majoring in political communication. So I was doing a social science. And I really liked that combination of social science and Jewish studies. And now, you know, I teach here in sociology and Jewish studies. So these trips are really formative for me in setting me on the career path that I've chosen. And ever since I made the decision that I wanted to pursue sociology of contemporary Jewish life as a career, I knew that one of the things that I wanted to look at were these Israel trips, because they had been so influential in my own life. And I wanted to understand what's it all about. The standard explanations of what these trips do, you know, we'll talk about the magic of Israel and things like that. And, you know, as a sociologist, that's not the approach that I take to explaining what's going on. I want to understand what are the social processes that are involved in this, and how does that shape identity?
The word pilgrimage appears in the subtitle of your book. Yet, instead of focusing your observations using the lens of pilgrimage, you decide to use the lens of tourism. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean by tourism, which seems to be pretty crucial to the arguments you're making in your book, and how it differs from pilgrimage and why you decided to use tourism rather than pilgrimage as the focus.
Sure. Yeah, I went back and forth on this a lot in the course of writing, and there are a lot of deleted pages that are, you know, talking about the trips as pilgrimage and really drawing deeply from the well of anthropological literature on tourism. And some of that still comes through. I decided to use the frame of tourism rather than pilgrimage to understand what was going on these trips for two reasons, really. The first is that when you think about what a pilgrimage is, you're making an assumption about the destination and about the traveler's orientation to the destination. This is a travel to a center. This is a travel to a place that is important to the person who's going on the pilgrimage. And I did not want to make those presumptions, because one of the things that I discovered when I was doing my early rounds of field work was that, look, you're talking about 200,000 plus people going on these trips. There are a lot of mixed motivations, different motivations. I also saw, even among the same people, their motivations change over the course of the trip. So I did not want to make any presumptions about the relationship between the travelers and the destination. And I found that the pilgrimage frame locked me in to, to thinking about, these are people who are going to Israel because Israel is a sacred Jewish center. For some people, that's absolutely true. For other people, they're going because it's an opportunity to be with friends, because it's an exciting foreign travel experience. So that was one reason. The other reason was that when I was thinking even about what goes on in modern pilgrimage generally, we talk about the Hajj, look at how much of modern contemporary pilgrimage is really rooted in an infrastructure of modern mass tourism. So when I was looking at Birthright, in order to study this and to do participant observation, I have to get my tickets, I have to get on the plane with the people, I have to go through passport control, I'm staying in the hotels with them, I'm traveling on the tour buses, we have the tour guides. The infrastructure for this is entirely drawn from modern mass tourism. And so I decided that that really was the place to be looking to understand what's going on as a contemporary phenomenon. I did not want to reproduce part of the internal discourse within these trips that this is the modern version of the ancient Jewish pilgrimage festivals, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot, when all the Jews in Israel and Judea would go up to Jerusalem to make their sacrifices, and this is simply the modern continuation of it. I really see this as discontinuous. This is something that could not, first, this did not exist 100 years ago, right? And it could not exist before, not just before there was a modern state of Israel, but it couldn't exist before you had a whole infrastructure of modern tourism. So for those reasons, I decided tourism really was the lens that was going to give me the most analytic purchase on what I was trying to study.
Early in the book, you talk about Israeli birthright tourism as having at least two de facto purposes, and these differ. I think you go to some length to discuss, or at least mention how these purposes that differ from the purposes you've already talked about. That is, the purposes that the organizers of these tours have. And the purposes that you're mentioning, these de facto purposes, are political socialization and diaspora building. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by those terms.
Sure. If you speak to the program organizers and the tour educators, they would not use these terms at all. They would say, this is about Jewish identity building, Jewish education, building ethnic identity, shaping religious identity, and bringing people close to Israel. The notion of this being a form of political socialization and something that has to do with strengthening diaspora communities, diaspora, building diaspora, rather than creating connections with Israel, is something that is not part of the native discourse of these trips. But as I was looking at the programs, one of the things that I was beginning to realize was that there are many ways in which Jews can identify as Jewish, and the program, although it speaks about building Jewish identity, is missing something in that it's not giving the qualifiers. What qualifiers? What type of Jewish identities are being built? Okay, so clearly, if you wanted to do a Jewish identity building travel program in the States, you know, and these things exist, you could go to the Lower East Side, and there are programs that do that. There are programs that will just take Jewish kids cross-country. They're seeing some Jewish sites, but a lot of other sites that are not Jewish. I participated before this Israel trip in high school on a synagogue youth movement tour where we were at truck stops and we were wrapped up in tallis and tefillin, the prayer shawl and phylacteries, you know, praying in the middle of of nowhere. These were instances of Jewish identity building tourism. So what's political socialization about this? It's the Israel trips are trying to create a connection with a modern nation state, in addition to everything else that they're doing. And that dimension of being connected to a country is something that has inherent political dimensions that I think were important to draw out. In addition to that, it's not just political in the sense that it's building connections with a country and shaping a Jewish identity that has the state of Israel as an important dimension of it, not necessarily Israel-centered, but certainly Israel-informed. It's also making claims about, I'll say American Jewish life, but it's a diaspora Jewish life more broadly, and legitimate ways of identifying oneself. The notion that one's only loyalty is to the country in which one holds citizenship is something that is challenged by these trips. These trips are saying that multiple allegiances, multiple loyalties, multiple identifications are something that's legitimate, and that multicultural societies have a space for these diasporic transnational identities, identification with communities that are not in the place where one lives, but that really do span the globe. So it's also political in that sense, which brings us to the issue of diaspora building. If you go back to the early history of the Zionist movement, what you'll find is that Zionism began by making claims against the Jewish diaspora. And it began by saying that Jewish life in diaspora, where Jewish life is everywhere in diaspora, everywhere in a position of being a minority culture among other cultures, is inherently disempowering and is... At the time, they were looking at, this is late 19th, early 20th century, they were looking at Europe, also inherently unsustainable. Either anti-Semitism or assimilation are going to lead to the destruction of Jewish communities. And you know, unfortunately, in the European case, it was clearly a prescient argument that they were making. But Zionism has these roots in a notion that Jews have one place of belonging, and that is in Israel, in a national homeland, and that the quality of Jewish life in an independent Jewish state is far superior to anything that diaspora might offer. Okay, now, from the Israeli perspective, these types of trips that are bringing diaspora Jews to Israel have, in the past, been used as ways of encouraging diaspora Jews to make aliyah, to move to Israel, to fulfill themselves as Jews in this mold. Diaspora programs, and the people who are involved on the diaspora side of this, never fully bought into this argument. And the thing that's really significant about the use of tourism to Israel from the diaspora side is that it really was never about the one-way trip. It was always the round-trip ticket. We're going to send our kids to Israel to bring them back here to strengthen Jewish life in the communities where they're coming from. And Birthright Israel, you know, was very clear about that at the beginning. This was a program that was not started by the State of Israel. It was started by diaspora philanthropists, and the government of Israel was actually reluctant to do this at first. And people were saying, look, why should we spend our tax dollars on affluent American Jewish kids when we can be spending it on the Israeli poor? So the programs are not classically Zionist in the sense that they are affirming even though they're taking people to Israel, it's with an intention of bring them back to where they're to the states and other countries that they're coming from to strengthen Jewish life there. There's more to it because there's disagreement among the program providers as to what the mission is. There are multiple missions that are going on, and there's some conflict and contestation, and you can see this stuff play out in differences among the Israeli guides and the American guides that are working jointly as staff on the trips. From the Israeli perspective, you know, the notion of placing Israel at the center of Jewish identity is something that is, I mean, it's almost taken for granted and seen as something that, you know, of course, this is what we should be doing. And tourism, you would think, oh, what a great way of doing it, because you're physically bringing people there, right? It's for this 10-day period, this is intense concentration and focus on Israel and how I, as a diaspora Jew, coming here, relate to this country and how it relates to me. But one of the things that, this is one of the contradictions of tourism, this is one of the ways in which you see something through the tourism lens that you won't see through the pilgrimage lens. Tourism is really premised on this attraction of seeing something that's different, right? If it's all the same, you may as well just stay home. So when people are going on a tour, they're looking to see the things that are unlike what they're familiar with. That's what makes the traveling worth it. But what this does, in calling attention to all the things that are different, it really does help to highlight the ways in which the diaspora Jews are foreigners in Israel. The standard line that Jewish tourists will hear when they land in Israel and they're coming with a tour group, the tour guide will welcome them. You know, welcome to Israel, welcome home, right? Jewish tourists, welcome home. And that happens. But at the same time that happens, there are other messages that are coming. Even before they get to the tour guide, the first thing that these Jewish tourists have to do, and it's the same that all the tourists have to do, is go through passport control. So what does passport control say? Passport control says, show me your documents to prove to me that you actually don't belong here, that you belong somewhere else. I want to see those papers from that country where you do belong, where you have your citizenship. And then, you know, once you show those papers, if you're lucky, you know, you get the stamp, and that stamp will say, you're allowed to come in here for 3 months, and you can't work, and all these other things that you could do if you were really home, if you really did belong here, right, you're not allowed to do because you're a guest. If you want to have citizenship, you have the option because Israel has the law of return, but as long as you're coming in as a tourist, you're still a tourist. So there are a lot of mixed messages, and these mixed messages are something that work against the idea of a Jewish identity that is solely centered on Israel. The trips shape an identity that's informed by Israel, but it is informed as much by the recognition among the tourists of how they're not Israeli as how they feel connected to the place.
That actually leads me to another question that you cover at length in a chapter on distance, so I wanted to turn to that. You've already talked a little bit about this, but perhaps we can go into a little bit more in detail. As you've just been saying, these tourists come to what they're told is their home, yet they face all of these various kinds of things like passport control, a language that they may or may not understand, a sense of threat, a physical threat, that constantly reinforces this notion that they are not necessarily at home in any sense of home that they might understand. So there's this distance created at that point, and there's also a distance that's created by the in-group dynamics that develop in these tours. That the tourists and you talk about this as well. The tourists have their gaze directed inward at one another at their groups, and this also kind of distinguishes them from what's going on outside of them, from Israel, from Israelis, from anything other than themselves. How do the tour guides address this paradox or this contradiction between an attempt to kind of make these people feel at home and also but with all of these distancing things going on. And how also do the participants, I mean, do the participants attempt to bridge this gap?
Yeah, they absolutely do on all sides. I think one of the important things to realize about this is that this is not a haphazard use of tourism. You know, people think tourism, they think Disneyland, and they think Vegas. You have had now for over 50 years educators, people steeped in the philosophy of education, Deweyan experiential education, who have been thinking and developing ways of using a tourist situation to shape identity. And it's really systematic, and it's really sophisticated in the way that they're thinking about these types of things. There's been a lot of research on other diaspora homeland tours, and the basic conclusion of all of them is these tours that are supposed to, you know, create connection actually make people realize also how distant they are. And I'll tell you, that's the starting point for this. The educators who are working in the Israel experience field realized this stuff, you know, 50, 40, 30 years ago, and have developed strategies to try to deal with that contradiction in the medium that they're using. So what types of things do they do? Well, one of the most popular now is a program called Mifgash, which is Hebrew for encounter. And what that does is it brings Israeli peers onto the tour buses as fellow tourists, so that it's not that you have foreign tourists who are separated by a bus window looking out at the Israelis on the other side, right? Now, by bringing Israelis onto the bus, that bus window doesn't divide up, doesn't allocate, you know, who's native, who's local, who's the tourist, who's not, who's looking at whom. There are friendships that are formed on the bus among the Israelis and the Americans. After the trips, for the people who stay in Israel to extend their stay on their own, you know, it's very common that they will then go and spend time with the Israeli friends that they made on the trip. And when the Israelis are then traveling abroad, it's also very common that the Israelis will come to visit the diaspora Jews who they meet on these programs. So one of the things that they try to do is to actually create real person-to-person connections that don't have that power dynamic of, you know, I'm here and I have my camera pointed at you, so I have the power over you. You're here in my space and I know all the stuff that you don't know and I'm going to take advantage of you. Now, they're both put together on these trips as co-tourists, and that helps to break down barriers. It's just one thing that they do. Other things that they do, they will use role modeling. And the role of the guides is really, really important here. The guides are not supposed to only convey information about the country. It's not just that they're reading the spiel about, you know, on this site in the year so-and-so, such and such happened. The guides really are supposed to model an engagement with the country, a love for the country, and it's through the traveler's relationship with their guides and their respect for their guides and their admiration for their guides that they look to them really as role models and then can see themselves doing the same thing. As I'm talking, I'm thinking about it. You know, I said at the beginning of our conversation, you know, that when I was on this trip in high school and I knew at the end of my trip that I did want to come back to spend a longer time in Israel because I felt like I just got a taste. I want more of this. What did my guides, the American guides, say to me? Canadian, actually. They said, you can do what we did. We spent a year studying at Hebrew University. Well, I'll do it, you know. So that type of thing, that works. From the participant's point of view, there are things that the trip is structured to create some distance. And it's structured to create distance in that the itinerary is fixed, and you don't have you don't have control. You can't tailor it to what you want. But, you know, when you're deciding which of the birth rate trips you're going to go on, you can choose. I'm going to go on a religious trip. I'm going to go on a secular trip. You know, I'll go on a trip that has a lot of outdoor stuff like hiking and biking. I'm going to go on a trip that's focused on something else. But once you're on the program, you know, all 40 people on the bus are doing the same thing, and there's very little time alone. Most of the time is spent in this public space, which is the bus, and everyone's doing everything together. And that distances people from the country because so much of their time is spent with the group and really in lockstep with the program. So what you see is mostly at free time, people will try to break out on their own and carve out some type of unique personal interaction. And it's usually happening with in stores, with vendors, or some people will go wander a little bit, but free time really is where this happens. But then what happens is people come and they have these unique experiences. They bring these back to the group. They say, hey, guess what I did? And they're telling their story. So what becomes unique and differentiates people so that they're not just having a standard cookie cutter experience, then gets fed back into the group. It wins them some status in the group. You have a really good, unique Israel experience that no one else had. Wow, that's very special. So that's what, but that's, it's interesting because this is a pressure that the tour itself creates. Because the tour is it's mass tourism and it's McDonaldized in that sense, it creates this pressure for people to go out and explore further on their own because it creates a sense that, well, if I'm just sticking with the tour, I'm not really seeing all that there is to see and the stuff that I need to see.
Another characteristic, I guess, of mass tourism, certainly a characteristic of mass society now, is the whole notion of being a consumer. And you talk about the whole concept of consuming spaces is one of the chapters. Just to kind of explain what I mean so that our listeners know what I'm talking about. In one of your chapters, you focus particularly on a city in Israel, Tzfat. It's a representative center for Jewish mysticism. And you talk about how the participants on these tours are consuming this city. They're taking pictures, they're buying souvenirs, they're encouraged to view various portions of the city, like a synagogue and a wall with graffiti on it, as consumers, as consuming and sort of taking part in the narrative of the Jewish people, as you mentioned, and in order to help them construct a Jewish identity. And more generally, you talk about how this goes on throughout Israel. It's not restricted to this particular city. And then this leads you at the end of that chapter to suggest that the tourists are interacting with their homeland aesthetically rather than morally. And I'm interested in your talking not only about this whole notion of these tourists, the participants of these tours as consumers, but also about this opposition that you see between the aesthetic appreciation of a homeland and kind of a moral responsibility or moral engagement with the homeland.
The engagement with the country, I was really focused on what are the tourists actually spending their time doing. And as I was looking at what the behaviors on the ground were, and I was thinking about it in relationship to what the rabbis might say normative Jewish practices are, I was really struck by the difference. And it really came through to me in touring synagogues. There's a traditional Jewish concept, three Jewish Hebrew terms for the synagogue in traditional Jewish lexicon. Beit Knesset, Beit Tefillah, Beit Midrash, a house of assembly, a house of prayer, and a house of study. And all these are the activities that go on in a synagogue. We were in Tzfat and in other places as well. We went into a synagogue, the Ari synagogue. Ari was a famous rabbi Kabbalist. We go into the synagogue, and before we go in, we spend about 10 minutes in the courtyard. We hear the story of the synagogue's history. We hear a story about mysticism that had some tangential connection to the place. We walk in, and we very quickly, go through. In 5 minutes, we're in and we're out. And when we're in, we're looking at the blue painted walls. We're looking at the tapestry that's covering the ark where the Torah is held. We're looking at the synagogue architecture. We're just looking around, and there's another group behind us. We're taking pictures. We were not there to assemble. We were not there for prayer, and we were not there for study. Right? We were there to get it. We were inside to get a sense of, you know, what does this place look like? What does it feel like? To appreciate the architecture. For those who had spent time in synagogues in the States, to recognize, wow, you know, this synagogue does not look like synagogues that you would find in America. There are a lot of different physical characteristics to it. So what were we using this place as? If we were not using it for study, for prayer, or for assembly, we were really there to appreciate it. And we were there to not only to appreciate it in and of itself, but also as part of our day in Tzfat, in Safed, the city that was being presented to us as the center of Jewish mysticism. We were there looking at the synagogue as one way of helping us understand the city as a whole, as a place where mysticism is important. So we were consuming the space in that way. It's not a way that people will typically relate to the synagogues, to their houses of worship that they belong to, that they're members of, that they will go to, you know, themselves or with their parents or the like. This is a different mode of practice. And, you know, tourism takes a bad rap in so many ways. And I think it's, you know, people said, so what's your normative stance in this book? Normative stance, I don't know. I'm just analyzing it, you know, I'm trying to make sense of it for myself. But if I have a normative stance, it's that tourism is not silly. Tourism is really, really serious, serious stuff. And to dismiss this mode of engaging with the synagogue, you know, as, look, it's not prayer and it's not study, it's not assembly, so it's not important, I think is missing the significance of it. Through touring the synagogue, through experiencing the synagogue in this way, people, the tourists are creating a new way of enacting some type of an engagement with a place, some type of a Jewish engagement as Jews with a synagogue. That there's no traditional language for this. It's something that's very new in that sense. And one of the things that I think these trips do very powerfully, and it is largely unrecognized by the planners of these trips, is that in this 10-day period, you have a concentration of these types of Jewish consumption practices, where people are engaging with Jewish symbols and enacting, performing some type of a Jewish identity by looking at synagogues, by purchasing Judaica souvenirs, mezuzahs, shofars, things like that, by literally consuming food. They're going to taste Jewish foods. You know, they may have tasted before, but they're going to taste them there. This is probably, maybe for the first time in the tourists' lives, this is probably the most concentrated experience of Jewish consumption and of a Jewishness through consumption that these people have. And because the trips really they're generally not promoting a single religious line. This is how you should behave Jewishly. You know, it's more about how you experience this stuff as a consumer. This is a crucially important dimension of modern identity. You know, that the consumer identity. I'm thinking back. You know, back in the must have been the early 2000s. I don't know if it's true, it would be apocryphal, but there was talk that Karl Rove, President Bush's political advisor, had this database he was using in the elections, where how they could identify the likely Bush voters, and it was based solely on consumption patterns. What kind of car were they driving? What magazines did they subscribe to? You know, what were people buying? And, you know, so you're driving a pickup, you're driving a Prius, you know, we can make a reasonably good prediction about who you're going to be voting for. And that's how they would target their direct mail. So what these trips do is they tap this dimension of modern identity through consumption, and they frame it in a Jewish way. They allow Jewishness to be expressed through that. You don't get that from synagogues, and you don't get that from political action, political organization. You don't get that from Hadassah. You don't get it from AIPAC and the like. I'm sure that this is something that was never explicitly planned or raised to the consciousness of the people who designed this, but it's very, very powerful. And just because it's not normative doesn't mean that it's not significant.
Kind of following up on that in a way, or at least following up on the whole issue of this construction of Jewish identity. You talk about how the tourist gaze, the tourist gaze, what these tourists are seeing, how they're observing, perceiving. The gaze turns inward, and it ends up focusing on, and I'm going to quote you here, one narrow slice of the participant's existence, those aspects of experience that have something to do with their perception of themselves as Jews. Can you talk a little bit more about this sort of narrowing? And I was wondering, is this a narrowing that's something that you see or that you could see in other kinds of tourist activities beyond the Israeli birthright tourism?
You can absolutely see it in other types of tourism. A few years ago, Vanderbilt University had it was Freedom Ride 2007, where some of the original Freedom Riders joined faculty and students from Vanderbilt and other Nashville area colleges and universities to retrace the steps of the original Freedom Riders. It was a bus trip down south from Nashville, and it was 2 days, but it was 2 days of focused attention to issues of race in America, and it framed the way that we on the trip thought about ourselves in that time. You know, everything else for the moment was put to the side, and we had this concentrated time simply to focus on this single issue. How do we as individuals relate to these broader social phenomena and historical forces and the like? And you talk to people who went on that trip. It was only 2 days. And at the end of the trip, you know, the people felt profoundly moved by it and also very committed to the ideals of the civil rights movement. By virtue, you know, people had these commitments to begin with, I would imagine, but it really lit people's fire. And what was happening on that trip is something that I was also seeing on the birthright trips. If you think about in your own life how many different roles you juggle in the course of a day, how many different ways you identify yourself, and how from moment to moment, situation to situation, you know, a certain aspect of the self is coming to the fore, and other aspects of the self are then being pushed aside. But then very quickly, things can switch, and you're juggling these things. And that's the complexity of life, and it never really lets you focus on any single aspect. There's a lot of balance going on. Juggling, balance. I guess juggling's depends on if you want to phrase it optimistically or pessimistically. What these trips do is they carve out a block of time, like this liminal space, where the only thing that, on paper, that the only social identity that is important in the program is that of Jewishness. Okay, this is the criteria for going on the trip. You want to receive the free trip, you have to be Jewish. What does that mean to be Jewish? You have to look the Hillel rabbi in the eye and say, you know, in this area, Jewish? Yeah, I'm Jewish. On the trips themselves, there are other identities that do come up and play roles. But the official, from the official perspective, this is really a trip for Jews about being Jewish. And what they're doing while they're there is touring Israel. And how is Israel being framed? It's being framed in terms of the arc of Jewish history. There were places that we visited up on the Golan Heights, for example. There's a nature reserve. We were looking at a babbling brook. we could have looked at this brook, you know, and thought about Thoreau and Walden Pond and thought about, you know, water and nature and things like that. You know, we were looking at it from the perspective of 1967, 73, Six-Day War, Yom Kippur War, Israel, Syria, politics, water, security, all that stuff. We were not looking at it, you know, as watershed managers. And if we were a tour of watershed managers, we might have looked at it differently and understood something different. So the meanings that were being ascribed to the place were particular meanings. And they were all about Jewishness, about the significance of Israel in the arc of Jewish history. And so what's being presented on the trips is a way of looking at the place and relating to the place that's choosing this one specific thing, Jewishness, as the unifying theme of all the places that you're looking at. And at the same time that that's happening, they are having group discussions where, and this actually goes back to the distancing question. You know, one of the ways that the trips try to overcome the distancing effect is to gather people in essentially consciousness-raising groups where they can share their experience and reflect back and process. But these are all structured and led by the tour guides. They're talking about their relationship as Jews to this place and this Jewish narrative that they're hearing about, seeing, learning about. They're being asked to reflect on their own autobiographies as Jews. How did you come to this place? How do you feel about it? Where do you see yourself going, Jewishly, from here? And this is the slice of life that's defined as situationally relevant on the trip. And not just for each individual traveler, but because this is happening as a group, you know, they're looking at each other and they're saying, oh, you know, I can see the other person is talking about himself or herself, you know, through this Jewish autobiography, and so is that other person. We're all doing this together. And what that does is it bonds the group. It creates a very powerful sense of autobiographical coherence. Your life hangs together because there's one unifying thread that you can now weave different. You can tie together different aspects of your life, and now you can make sense of it in terms of a Jewish story. And not only can you do it, but you see everyone else can do it as well. And the things that are, you know, that don't bear on that, don't worry about that for now. You know, for these 10 days, you put that to the side. You can deal with that later. But it's that narrowing of the story of the self that provides the sense of coherence that is one of the sources of emotional power on the trips. Implications, though, for post-trip, once you go back into these situations where all these other identities come back into play, is that the sense of life coherence that is generated on the trips is very fragile. You know, it's very much rooted in the particulars of the social environment that's sustaining it. But that social environment is evanescent. You know, it dissolves once the trip ends. And what you have after the trip, then, are different trajectories of people in terms of how they relate to this thing. You know, so some people try to recapture it. How do they recapture it? They have to search for ways. Some will say, you know what, it's the place. It was not the social environment of the tour. It's the place itself that creates this feeling. I have to go back. Others will say, you know, this is about Jewishness, not just about Israel. I'm going to get very involved in my Jewish community, you know, here where I live. For other people, you know, that very nice. It worked for that moment. And, you know, but the situation's different, so long. And then for others, you know, at times in their life when the Jewish piece gets activated, it could be a wedding, it could be a holiday season, right? You know, it comes back to the fore.
Throughout that question and then some other responses that you've made, it's clear to me, and it's certainly clear in the book, that this, the work that goes on in these tours is not simply a matter of the tour guide standing up, telling people what to think, and the people sort of just sit there and kind of absorb it all and go on. And you know, it's not like a brainwashing kind of situation.
Definitely not.
And you discuss this in at length with the particular example of the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. As I was just saying, you know, you argue that The kind of political socialization that's going on in these tours is more complex than somebody standing up delivering a sort of a monolithic narrative that everybody absorbs. And you talk a lot about, in that chapter and in other parts of the book, and it's come up in this conversation and kind of underlying it, various non-discursive practices that are involved in political socialization and diaspora building. I wonder if you could talk about that, and also about what I thought was kind of an interesting observation, kind of curious observation, the inattentiveness that the participants display to what's going on. So even if you did have a monolithic narrative, the people might not even be listening to what you're talking about.
Yeah. You know, it goes to the issue of when you're doing participant observation of what do you deem significant, what do you pay attention to. And you know, my approach to it is I try to pay attention to the things that you would think, oh, it doesn't matter because it's not officially part of the program. So all that inattention and disattention, you know, seems, well, that's irrelevant. It's missing what's really going on, because the action is, you know, it's in this core narrative that the guide is trying to get out. No, this is a really rich, complex experience with a lot going on, a lot of different actors at the same time, and what's happening in the program, you have all these moving parts that are interacting in ways where sometimes you get these amplifier effects and sometimes you get canceling effects, and so this inattentiveness was really important to me. And I know that it's very easy when you're sitting with a recorded transcript of what the guide says to go and, you know, you go word, line by line, word by word, and you can nitpick every single, you know, nuance. And I'll tell you, the experience of sitting, you know, with a transcript, reading it over and over and over again, is fundamentally different from the experience of being on the trip itself, hearing it while there's so much else going on around. And I really, really tried in the course of writing to remain aware of, you know, of how much more information I had just by virtue of having a transcript in front of me than I had at the moment when I was there going through it. And so I tried to put myself back into that mindset of listening and not listening and attending to lots of different things, which everyone was doing, at the same time, and then see, all right, so what comes out of it there? You know, the notion that the programs have a clear political line on issues of Israeli-Palestinian politics is I think is a common misperception, both among some critics of the program and some boosters of the program. You know, the critics are saying, "Oh, look, you're taking these diaspora Jews who really don't understand what the politics are about over there, and you're giving them a simplistic narrative, you know, and then you're going to send them back and then have them lobby for one political party's version of what should be." And on the other, and then on the other hand, you have these boosters who are saying, you know, there's a crisis. You know, Israel is losing support around the world, and diaspora Jews need to mobilize on its behalf. And what better way to do that now that we have them here to show them what's really going on, and then they're going to go back and become activists. Now, the original intent of these programs was never about that. The program actually was born in 1998, 1999. This was at a time when the peace process was actually moving forward. Ehud Barak was was the prime minister at the time, and this was before the Camp David negotiations between Barak and Arafat and Clinton collapsed. But there was a sense that, you know what, the conflict's going to be resolved. The issue for the people who started the trip was, this is about diaspora Jewish life and strengthening diaspora Jewish identity. Israel is the means to the end. After the peace process collapsed, the Second Intifada happened, all of a sudden you had voices within the community of supporters of the program who began to reframe what the mission was, so that it was less focused on, you know, on diaspora Jewish identity and more on building political support for Israel, you know, in a time of increasing violence. But you have a lot of different, you have a diverse political spectrum in Israel to begin with, and all of these views are reflected on the trips themselves. One of the effects of bringing the co-tourists, the Israelis, onto the bus is that it's not only the tour guide who can voice an Israeli perspective. It's no longer the tour guide is the voice of Israel. you now have a lot of voices. I should just, to be clear, the tourists who are coming on are all officers in the Israel Defense Forces. And they are prepped before they come about how to be ambassadors for the country. That said, you know, there are ambassadors and there are ambassadors. And a lot of times what you'll get when the political conversations start happening are the Americans will take a backseat and they'll watch the Israelis duke it out. You know, that's not right. You know, that's your perspective, but I think differently. That's one party. The other party would say this. So you do get a diversity of voices. In terms of the non-discursive, you know, everything that goes beyond the words, you know, some of the things that happen, for example, the people who go on these trips very quickly learn to understand themselves as potential targets of terrorism from Hamas or the like. And you actually see this, you know, if you look at the website, what are the security arrangements on the trip? It's a concern that the participants and their parents have going in, and the program tries to allay these concerns, you know, by saying these are the precautions that we take, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time that they're allaying the fears, they're also calling attention to this. The experience of being there and knowing who one should be afraid of, you know, is a really powerful piece of, you know, understanding, of having the tourists understand themselves as aligned with Israel, with Israel rather than with Palestinians. You know, there are other trips as well. It's very small, but you call it a rival trip called Birthright Unplugged, which it takes, it's had probably a few hundred people, nowhere near the 200,000 plus. But, you know, it flips this on its head so that the relationship with Palestinians is not one of fear, but one of camaraderie. And with Israeli soldiers is not one of camaraderie, but one of fear. So these are all types of non-discursive practices that help to shape identification.
I have to ask, I mean, it was a question that came to my mind in reading the book. How does age affect your whole study? I mean, all of these people are in their late teens, early 20s, I assume. I mean, I don't know if there are programs for, you know, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 60-year-olds. Does age have any effect that you can tell in how the program's constructed, how the people react, the participants react to the program, how they react to one another?
Yeah, sure. Look, it's very different being on a trip with a bunch of 20-year-old singles and being on a trip with a bunch of, 40, 50-year-old married couples. You know, the group dynamic is different. And it's interesting, you know, in the reviews of the book so far in the Jewish press, you know, they basically all picked up on I have 5 pages that talk about sex on the trip. You know, and I'm talking really about sex on the trip and how and what its implications are for the identity work that the trips are trying to do, how it gets in the way of the Mifgash program, you know, because not everyone has a chance to befriend the Israelis, because, you know, once the Israelis are pairing off, you know, with one American or two Americans, right? You know, that it affects it. But you know, it was 5 pages, but it's, if you read the reviews, you would think that's the whole thing. But clearly, it's a very important piece of it. And I'll come back to it in a sec. But you know, these types of tours began in the 1950s. Targeting Jewish youth movements and the elite of the youth movements. These were seen as leadership development program for high school students. This, with Birthright, there was a shift in emphasis to college age, and part of the reason that the shift was made was because the people who were designing the program were thinking about the psychology of identity development over the life course, and they came to the conclusion that if you want to shape identity, ethnic identity, religious identity, political identity over the long term, the college years really are a formative period, and that, therefore, is when you do it. You get them in high school, and then they're going to go off to college, and they're going to blossom in other ways. You get them in college where they're already in this process of self-exploration, then this can become a part of it. You get them after they're, you know, after they're settled down in a career, possibly in a family, their room for self-creation is constrained. You can't reinvent yourself. You can always reinvent yourself, but there are limitations. You're more of a free agent when you're, you know, when you're a young single in college. So these programs made the strategic decision that they're going to be focusing on this age group. Side note, another use of Jewish tourism to Israel for these types of identity connection forging purposes are the UJA missions to Israel, you know, which is, these have been going on for years and years and years, and this is philanthropic leadership development. That's happening, you know, with a much older age cohort. Extremely effective as well. What does the age thing do for the dynamic? You know, it makes it, it increases the attention to the internal dynamics of the group, who's with whom, and, you know, and not just in terms of, you know, who's dating whom, but who's friends with whom, and what are the cliques that are forming. You know, so in that sense, it has that, you know, front of the bus, back of the bus type of dynamics that with an older tour you don't get. One of the critiques that has been made, which I don't share, is that what this ends up doing is it focuses the tourists inside the bus looking at each other and ignoring what's going on around them. My own take on it is that while it does get them focused inside the bus on the group dynamic, there's a very permeable wall. And as I mentioned before, people are taking their stories of what they're doing, you know, off on their own during free time and bringing them back into the group and gaining status in the group. So the focus on the group also is something that helps to connect people with Israel. And ultimately, I think what it does is their understanding of Israel that's shaped by this is not really an understanding of Israel per se. It's an understanding of what it's like for them as tourists to be in Israel in the context of this type of a tour program. So it's a very personalized, idiosyncratic understanding of me in Israel, in this group context. So I go back later in other contexts and they'll discover, oh, there are other ways of understanding myself in relationship to the place.
Well, there are probably quite a few other questions that I could ask, but I think we're running out of time, so I'm going to just thank you again for doing this interview. It's been very interesting to talk about the Israeli birthright tourism and get some more insight into what you were writing about. Again, I've been talking with Shaul Kellner, author of the recent book Tours That Bind, Diaspora Pilgrimage and Israeli Birthright Tourism, published this year by New York University Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing you, and thanks for listening.